Welcome back to the Diary of the CFO. Today, I'm super delighted to have with me Tamika Williams. She is the Chief Financial Officer of the Athena Community Food Bank, where she leads efforts to modernize financial operations and drive strategic growth. With over two decades of experience in accounting and finance, Tamika has built a reputation for her expertise in developing high-performing teams, improving processes, and aligning financial strategies with organizational goals. As a CPA and a certified internal auditor CIA, Tamika has held leadership roles in banking, private wealth management, and private equity, bringing a wealth of knowledge to the nonprofit sector. Welcome to the show, Tamika.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. I love your experience and how you have worked in for-profit before now coming into not-for-profit. So what initially draw you to accounting and then to not-profit? How was your leadership journey until now?
I started my working career in my 20s as a math and science teacher. And I thought that it was the right path for me at the time because I love information. But I soon found that I like information and I like utilizing information. So I found my way into accounting somewhere in my mid-20s. I all but scrapped a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's in education that I had and went back to school for a bachelor's in accounting and a master's in accounting. But I have worked in a few organizations over the years and I love accounting and finance at its core. In my private life, I had done volunteer work over the years with food pantries in my local area. And so that was a big part of my community work. And the opportunity at the food bank just seemed to bring both of those worlds together, my career world and my personal endeavor world.
Wow. That is amazing. That's like matchmaking. Now, tell me, why were you first involved with the food bank? Because, you know, when we think about volunteer work and non-for-profit, I always find out that the cause you volunteered with and for over a long period of time probably have something to do with, probably resonate with something in your life. So why volunteer with food banks in the first place?
Well, I'm a member of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated, the Noonan Graduate Chapter, and we do a lot of volunteer work in the community. And work at the food pantries is just a piece of that, but going back in my life, I come from what you would call a disadvantaged background. And my family in the late 80s, early 90s took advantage of opportunities to obtain food from food pantries, from churches, et cetera. And that has remained with me over the years. And now that I'm in a place in my life to give back, I like to give back to those types of causes, like you said, that resonate with something in my past. And the food bank does.
Wow, that is so inspiring because coming from a place of needing a food pantry service, so now leading finance, not just any area, finance at a food bank, that must be full circle for you.
It does feel full circle. And I'm very excited about the opportunity to do that, to lead the food bank in the area of finance. Like you said, it's kind of a match of both worlds.
Yes, yes. So what would you say if someone feels like they also come from a disadvantaged background and they may not have the right connections or background to move in your career, to take the steps you took, right? Because I'm originally from West Africa, Ivory Coast. And sometimes when you don't see that model in your family and around you, it's hard for you to see yourself and then start moving toward those things. So what would be your advice for someone like that?
You know, it took me many years to kind of come to this conclusion. And when I went to college, it was a huge eye-opener for me. You know, I came along in the 90s and at that time, you know, the Cosby Show was on television, A Different World, and there was this big push, you know, college was the answer, you know. So when I went to college, it really was a different world for me. And I was able to be exposed to different people. And I realized that for the most part, your background is irrelevant. Everything that you want to accomplish, those things that you want to have, that you want to achieve, are really dependent on what you're willing to do in your present and in your future. No matter your background, Focus on your present and your future. Start making those changes. And that's what I did. I had to make small changes in my life over time that built into a different set of habits that eventually got me to a different place in life.
That's amazing. And I like how you said you start pretty small, right? You start with a different set of habits, right? Because that's really what will help you do the long-term change we all want to see. So what would you say are some of the habits that helped you in that way?
Like I said, it's going to be starting with the small things. Whatever you're doing, do it 100%. Do not do it 80% and stop. Even if it's just cleaning up around the house, 100%. Everything at 100%, the smallest task. If you're outside and you see trash on the street and you walk by it, if it's something that you can pick up and easily throw away, then do that. Just the smallest habits. And those small habits turn into bigger habits that can really impact your life.
Wow. And now that you're a CFO of the Atlanta Community Food Bank, what's the most exciting part about the role so far? Or maybe what was the biggest adjustment?
You know, the most exciting part about the role is the same thing that has excited me throughout my accounting career. I love information and I love problem solving. And every day that I wake up, I feel like I'm ready to solve a challenging crossword puzzle or a challenging Sudoku puzzle. And so I walk into work ready for those puzzles, ready for those problems, and I leave every day with a sense of accomplishment. That is the excitement. Each day of more than 20 years, I still approach each day of work with that problem-solving puzzle mindset, and it's exciting for me.
That's awesome, because I used to think that accounting was going to be boring, and 15 years later, I'm still looking to be bored.
Yes, it's definitely not boring. There's a huge misconception out there for those that do not work in accounting and finance. They think that you're kind of just sitting there crunching numbers. And for the most part, you might do some of that in the beginning, but that is the preparation for the problem solving, the solutions oriented roles that you will move into. And that is very much what the CFO role is. It is a solutions-oriented role.
Wow. And for you getting to the CFO level, what would you say was the biggest adjustment for you? So between working in accounting and all the compliance and stuff, what was the biggest adjustment for you?
I think the biggest adjustment was time management. There is a different level to the time management skills that you must have when you work in accounting. I think when I was a freshman in college, my first semester was horrible. I had no time management skills, and I approached everything with the same mindset that I did in high school. And at the end of that first semester, I realized that, you know, what got me here won't get me there. I was in the bookstore one day, and there was a huge stack of calendar planners just there for free. So I took one and began to use it. And that planner changed my life. And I have used a paper calendar over, 20 plus years. I still use one today. But in addition to that, I use my Outlook calendar for work. And I approach my time management in much the same way that a nonprofit organization would approach zero-based budgeting. I zero-based budget my time. So if you open my Outlook, you will see that almost every block of a 30-minute segment is booked towards something, whether it be a report that I need to work on, follow up on a task, a meeting. I try to utilize all of that time and calendar, calendar, calendar. If you ask me something now and I say, oh, I'll look into that next week, I will go out to my Outlook and put a 30-minute block out there to look into whatever that is so that I don't forget it and make sure to get back to you.
I do the same. And a couple years ago, I discovered how you can drag a email into your calendar. Oh my God, that's like my favorite friend.
Yes, it's a game changer.
Now, you mentioned you approach it as zero-based budget as non-for-profit do. Can you please speak more to that? Because sometimes I think that not many people realize the difference between corporate finance, working for a for-profit versus a not-for-profit, especially when it comes to budgeting and planning. So since you work in both sectors, what are the key differences? How is the budget different when you're dealing with a not-for-profit versus a for-profit?
I think the key difference lies with your stakeholders. So in a for-profit organization, of course, the goal is always to maximize profits. And in a nonprofit organization, the goal is to maximize mission and impact. When it comes to the finances of a nonprofit organization, you want to manage your budget so that you can maximize your mission and impact while minimizing expense. Because a nonprofit organization is going to have just so much revenues coming in from grants, from donations, from whatever other sources. And the goal is to maximize the use of that revenue towards your mission and your impact. And so it's a delicate balance. The budget process it can be a tedious process, but you have to keep that delicate balance in mind. And something that we're doing at the food bank right now that's fairly new is somewhat of a more inclusive budgeting process in which I am working directly with my stakeholders within the business, so to speak. So my ELT, my managers, my directors, I am working with them hands-on for the next fiscal year budget. And so far, so good. You know, it has been an eye-opening experience for them, those that have never been involved in the budgeting process before. However, it gives them an opportunity to be hands-on with the finances that they will be held accountable to as we work through the next fiscal year. And I think that that experience is going to motivate them to adhere to the budget, to maximize our revenues, minimize expenses, to make a greater impact on our community.
That's awesome. And I think now, especially with the political climate, the things that are changing in the economy, the policy changes, it's so important to be in tune with what the programs, the businesses are, whether you're in a not-for-profit or not. So what you're doing is so important. But what would you say are some of the things you kind of had to educate or lead change for them? Because it's like from finance handling all of it, now I'm involved. So maybe I'm scared. Maybe I don't know how to do it. Maybe I don't want to do it. Like what has been your experience? What may be some best practice you want to share for somebody starting something like you're doing now?
I think the best practice would be to approach what you are doing with a mindset of innovation and adaptability. And innovation, of course, includes technology, but I think the use of technology is much broader or can be much broader than it used to be. So, for example, if you had asked me in the early 2000s when I started my career, kind of what would be the most important skill or non-financial skill for someone in accounting, the default answer would be technology. But now technology falls under a much broader umbrella of innovation. And so the key is to use technology as a tool to solve problems, to implement new ideas, to implement new ways of working and doing things, new ways of providing information. And working in a nonprofit, I have found that being innovative with the technology that you have is probably the greatest skill that you could bring to an organization. As we all know, nonprofits could have limited resources, limited technology. And so your innovation around the way that you use that technology to support the mission, to support the business, is a valuable skill that any organization could benefit from, but I think it's especially valuable with a nonprofit organization where your resources might be limited.
Yes. And when your resources are limited, how do you advocate for more resources for your department? because like you said, technology is great. Technology is not free. You probably have the low tier, high tier, mid tier, but at the end of the day, it involves spending. And a lot of time, the grants may not have room for infrastructure or capacity building. So how do you advocate for more resources for your accounting and finance team?
I think the simple answer is to do just that, to advocate for it. Lots of times, you know, with accounting and finance, you're not necessarily, or well, not necessarily, you're not a revenue generating part of the business. And so you're kind of in the background, and accounting and finance leaders will often forget to advocate for their teams, to advocate for resources. So I think it's important to do just that, to advocate for them. Now, as I mentioned, there's a delicate balance. And so when you advocate for those resources, you've got to find a way to sometimes maybe shift the focus of resources that you already have to meet your needs. And again, there's that innovation. You know, how do you maybe use the technology that you have, the people that you have, the resources that you have to do something different, to fill that gap that you feel you need to maybe have a different resource to fill? Maybe you can fill that in a way that you already have, and you're just not doing that. It's also good to kind of partner with your CIO or other technology professionals in your organization, because they may be able to help you fill that gap with existing technology. Then there's always the option to get new technology, to get new resources, but it may not be when you want them. So you may have to make do until you can get that resource. And the food bank has done that for a long time. We are working to implement new technology right now. And often, being a nonprofit, you're able to get consultation from other experts at a reduced cost, maybe even free. And you have to take advantage of that to maybe get resources that you do not have.
Yes, I know it's hard, like you said, in that period of you advocated for it, and the time you actually get it. So in that time, how do you manage your team? How do you maintain morale? How do you get motivated when they all have to be, you know, maybe stretched at some point, or just like, I don't know if I can still do it. Like, how do you manage your team and lead your team in those times?
I'll say this, positivity and optimism is my default setting. Every day, no matter what is going on in my life, I actually wake up with a mindset of positivity and optimism. And what helps with that is that I'm a very quick problem solver. And so, as you mentioned, when the team is stressed, when the team feels that they do not have the resources that they need, I'm able to quickly think of a way to supplement what they have, supplement those resources, think of a plan B, help them think in an innovative way about the problem that they're facing. And I do that while maintaining this default setting of optimism and motivation. And so it is contagious. It is contagious. And even in the most difficult times, when you can quickly problem solve, when you can quickly pivot to an innovative solution for your problem, and you can do it with optimism and motivation, and you can relay that, and your team sees that in your face every day, and they see that you're not stressed and that you are not unmotivated, even though sometimes I am, but I never show that. Then they know that they can do it too. They can approach those problems with that same optimism and motivation.
That's great. And it reminds me of something a former guest said, Cindy Wilson, about leadership being a lifestyle, but then being aware that how your personal life is can affect what kind of leader you show up to at work. So you said you wake up motivated, you wake up this way. What are some things maybe in your personal life and what you do outside of work that allow you to be the leader you are at work?
You know, it's funny because my daughter asked me a similar question not too long ago, but over the years, I have just developed the ability to turn off home Tamika and B, work Tamika. And when I leave work, I turn off work Tamika and I become home Tamika. And I don't know if it's a gift or a curse, but when I'm at work, I very rarely think about anything personal. Very rarely. I am in a zone of organization. I am in that zone. And when I leave that zone, I leave it. And so I can very easily just separate the two.
I want to know more. So give me some example of what work Tamika does that maybe home Tamika does not. Like now I want to know the difference between the two.
Well, you know, working 20 plus years and now being in my early 50s, I have had a life of challenges just as anyone has. And I think I had to train myself early in my career to just leave personal matters at home. And so, gosh, when I get to work, I can literally just turn it off and be focused on the task at hand, the mission at hand. And it's actually good for me because if I am dealing with something personal, I can shut that off and not have to worry about it, not have to think about it for 8, 9, 10 hours. And it gives me a mental break from that. Actually, whatever the issue might be that I'm going through personally, it gives me a break from that. And so it's good for the organization because I can be super productive, but it's good for me because it gives me a little bit of an escape. And so I've dealt with lots of things over the years, death in the family, I've raised a daughter, all of those things that, you know, and every mother knows. And I only had one child, so I only know what it's like for mothers of only children. But if something is going on with your child, something is going on with you.
1,000%.
Yes. And so that is a struggle when you're working early in your career, you're trying to build a career and you have a small child. That is a struggle. You have a school-age child and they go through the ups and downs that school-age children go through. The things that children go through in middle school, the self-esteem, the bullying, things of that type, those things impact you as well, and you carry them with you. And I think learning to turn those things off when I work has been maybe an escape and an adaptive mechanism for me over the years. And I just still utilize that adaptive skill.
That's amazing. So what would you say maybe made you start in the first place? Or maybe is it mentors or leaders you saw? Like what got you to be the leader you are today? Because I like how you said, I'm mindful basically of how I show up and I want to show up in a positive way because you know it's going to rub off on your employees. So you make that mental decision, probably automatic now without you realizing because you've done it for so long. But what are some of the things that helped you become the leader you are today?
Realizing early in my career that leadership exists at every pay grade. If you look around in your role, no matter where you are in your career, there are opportunities to lead. And if you want to be in leadership, so to speak, if you want to have that leadership title, you must first make the skill sets of a leader, the actions that a leader would take, you must first make that part of who you are. And you can start that at any level of your career. And that is what I did. So when I started my career as an accountant one, there were opportunities for leadership. They may not have been as big or as visible as they would be as you progress higher in your career, but those opportunities are there and you have to start where you are. And so once you do that and take advantage of leadership opportunities that are available to you as you move up the ladder, so to speak, then you will find that leadership becomes innate. And so when I am working every day, I do not consciously think about being a leader. It is now innate in what I do every day because I have taken advantage of leadership opportunities all the way from the bottom of the ladder to the top.
Oh, wow. And that goes back to what you said earlier. You're 100%.
Yes.
You're doing it 100%.
Absolutely. I learned that early on. And, you know, I can remember thinking to myself when I was about 18 or 19, as a matter of fact, it was around that same time of my first awful semester in college, you know, when I realized that I had to make a change or I would soon be out the door on academic suspension. Because my problem was not the learning. It was not the education. It was not the classes. My problem was time management. I can remember a specific incident in college in which my English 101 professor said, okay, turn in the papers. And, you know, this was the early 90s. So we were literally turning in physical papers. And Tamika did not have her paper because Tamika forgot all about the paper. And so I realized then that I had to make some changes. And I said to myself, okay, when I go to the doctor, I am dependent on that doctor to give me 100% of his efforts or her efforts. If I am sick, I am dependent on them to show up and give me 100% of everything that they know as a doctor to help heal me. Why am I not that same way in my everyday life? Why do I expect that from my doctor, from my teacher, from my lawyer, from any other professional whose services I would need in my life? I expect that, but am I doing that in my own life? No matter what career I'm in, no matter what I'm doing, am I giving people or am I giving this task 100% as I would expect someone else to do? And that is what I began doing. And when my daughter came along, that is what I taught her. And if we were walking in a store, if we were walking in TJ Maxx and there was a sweater that had fallen on the floor and it was just sitting there and everybody's kind of walking by that sweater right up against the rack on the floor. And I would say to my daughter, you see that? Don't walk by that. Don't be like everyone else. Pick it up and just place it across the rack. Don't walk by it and leave it there. And I raised her with those types of tidbits, I guess you could say, over the years. It paid off. And so now my daughter is now 27 and she has her bachelor's and her master's and she works as a therapist and she gives her 100% every day. And she approaches her work with a mindset of positivity and enthusiasm and motivation. And she's really making a difference in the lives of her clients with her therapy.
That's so inspiring. Wow. Congratulations to you and her. Definitely. But at the same time, I'm wondering in my head, like if I try to give 100% to everything that I do, will I not burn out? Like, how do you know what to drop, what to let go? Because sometimes it's hard to do everything at the same time. How do you give yourself grace? Even at work, right? Your team cannot do every project at once. Like, how do you find that balance?
Well, 100% doesn't have to be in one sitting.
Okay.
I may do 20% now. I may calendar 20% for next week, 20% for the week after, until I get to that 100%. And like you said, you know, everything, you may not be able to give 100%. Everything may not work out the way you want it to work out. And that's fine too. And so you say, okay, I put 30% into this, but this isn't working. I'll have to shift to plan B and see if I can get to 100% on that one, right? In my early career, I started out as a teacher. I wanted to give it 100%, but I realized that it wasn't for me. And so I had to find that career path in which I could put that 100%. And I did with accounting and finance. And I'm very happy with that. Never looked back. You have to remember that with anything, you have to be flexible, agile with your 100%. Maybe 100% for this particular task is 80%, depending on what you can do. You have to think about it with that mindset.
Love it. Love it. And how do you think, you just mentioned again, how do you think those early days as a teacher helped you in that transition? Because it is quite a pivot to move. And I have such an admiration for teachers after COVID, and I was stuck with my own two kids, and I was like, oh my God. I can't even keep my kids. And so what are some of the things that you think helped you in that transition? Maybe the background, maybe the work ethic, like what helped you in that pivot?
Yes, two words, emotional intelligence. That is something that I would say that is the most valuable skill that I gained from being a teacher, emotional intelligence, how to read people. Is this child experiencing something that has him off today? Is he not in the mood for learning? Do I need to pivot? Is the class as a whole not with it today? Can I sense where the mood is? What's going on? Do I need to pivot? Maybe this lesson that I had in mind for today isn't going to work because they're too energetic. They're too active. I need to pivot to a different lesson that's going to help them utilize some of that energy. And so just learning to utilize emotional intelligence and build those skill sets prepared me for the shift from education to the corporate world, because in the corporate world, I'm dealing with a group of people, just like a group of kids in the classroom. And I have to use those same emotional intelligence skill sets to read the room, to read my team, to read the board, to read the executive leadership team, so that I can perform in a manner that's going to be most effective for what's going on right now.
Wow. I had to learn this the hard way, and I almost feel great that you started your career in a field that helped you build it. I realized when you start right away in accounting and finance, you're not prioritizing those softer skills, the human skills, however you want to call it, because you go straight into debits and credits, straight into Excel, straight into compliance and tying the numbers to the penny, and you don't necessarily spend time on your emotional intelligence, which, like you said, it helps you read the room, read the people you're with. It doesn't matter what age, it's still important because we're human beings before being business leaders. So what would you say to someone that started in accounting and finance and not necessarily like you did as a teacher? What would you say can help someone build that emotional intelligence, build those kind of skills?
To go back to something I said about leadership earlier, I said that leadership opportunities are at every pay grade. And no matter where you are, you want to start now with those leadership skills. Same thing with emotional intelligence. You want to start now. Get to know the people that you're working with. Network. Join those professional organizations and get that exposure to different types of people, different types of personalities, different work styles, and understand the broad scope of the type of professionals that you will work with. Understand how those people think. You can get that experience from, you know, cross-functional tasks or projects within your own company. Work with people in IT, work with people in sales, in marketing. Just those cross-functional relationships will give you that exposure to people of different personalities, different mindsets, different ways that they approach things. And it will take time. And everyone has to develop those skills around emotional intelligence in their own way. But I think the similar base of developing those skills is to get out there and get that exposure to different types of people within organizations.
Yes, get out there, be exposed, right? Because some things you will only learn with experience, not the textbooks or the courses.
Right. And if you spend your day, every day, kind of heads down with similar people in accounting that are heads down, you're not going to develop those skill sets that you would need to read people of various professions, various personalities, various dynamics. Expose yourself to what's different out there. Cross-functional exposure is probably one of the best that you can do, because throughout an organization, you'll run into different types of people that are in different parts of the company that are totally different from accounting and finance. And you have kind of opportunities right there at your feet to gain that exposure to different types of people.
That's so good. That's so good. Thank you so much for all these gems. I'm loving it. And I can tell the breadth and the wealth of your experience and your perspective in everything you said. So I have two last questions for you. One, what's the best career advice you've ever received?
You know what? The best career advice that I've ever received was really a corporate slogan that someone said to me, and that's just do it. Just do it. The best career advice that I can give anyone is to just do it. There are a lot of tasks, a lot of projects, a lot of things that will come your way that you may not feel are in your job description or at your pay grade or at your skill set. But I find that if you just do it, if you're just willing to do more than you're getting paid for, if you're just willing to do more than you would get recognition for, if you're just willing to do that, at some point, you will get that pay. At some point, you will get that recognition. So don't be afraid. Don't be reluctant. Don't be adverse to just doing it. Do what you have to do. Just do it.
Yes, it will all compound in the end. Yeah, now I can't believe I'm saying that I'm grateful for some things I did earlier in my career. And I was like, I remember doing it mad. Like, wow.
But you did it.
I did it. Like, really. Like, I felt overworked, underpaid, what the heck. And today I'm like, thank God I did this. But it's hard to believe.
Yes. Just do it. You know, I was approached when I was in I was an accounting manager, and I was approached with an opportunity to travel and work weekly from Atlanta to Baltimore for work, to fill in for a controller that left a subsidiary company unexpectedly. And the assignment was to be 2 to 3 months. I love corporate travel. I love to work with new people. So I said, sure, I'll do it. Well, 3 months turned into a full year of flying to Baltimore every Tuesday and back to Atlanta every Friday. A full year. And my daughter at the time was about 14, 15 years old. And luckily, I had relatives that would take care of her during the week. And the relatives lived in my school district, so it was easy. But after about the 5th or 6th month, I said, wow, I'm doing this. There's no additional pay. This is stressful. I'm an accounting manager. I'm filling in for a controller. This is a skill set stretch. And no one has offered me any additional pay, no promotion, no nothing. But I stuck with it. I did it for a full year. And after that year was over, the pay came, the promotion came. And I don't think if I had not taken it, if I had not said yes to that opportunity, I don't think that I would have progressed further up the ladder into roles that got me where I am today. And because I was willing to do that at no extra cost to the company other than the travel expenses, you know, I didn't say, well, I'll do it, but I'm going to need, you know, $30,000 more. You know, I'm going to need an increase. I'm going to need this. I'm going to do that. I just did it. And in the end, it paid off. It was hard work. It was a challenge. My family suffered, so to speak. It was a huge challenge, but it paid off in the end. So sometimes, like I said, sometimes you just have to do it.
Sometimes you just have to do it. That's so true.
Yes. And people would say, why are you doing this? Why are you? And I said, well, it will pay off, whether it pays off here at this company or at the next company. This experience will pay off. And it did.
Yes. Kudos to you. Congratulations for that. Now, my last question. What's your favorite quote and why?
Oh, my favorite quote is something I found on the internet years ago. And I wrote it down and I used to have it taped to my monitor. And it's often attributed to Abraham Lincoln, but I read that it's not a quote of Abraham Lincoln. I don't know, but it's a really good quote. And it reads, "Good things may come to those who wait, but only those things left behind by those who hustle." So do you want to hustle or do you want to wait for the leftovers?
Wow. Drop the mic.
I choose to hustle.
Yes, 100% all the way. Wow. Thank you so much, Tamika, for being on the show. Oh my. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me. I've had a lot of fun. Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode of The Diary of a CFO. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like, review, subscribe, and share with others. Our website is thediaryofacfo.com. That's where you can find all the episodes, access all the guest profiles, see their bios and the social media links. It is also the place where you can apply to be a guest on the podcast and have information about how you can sponsor the show. As always, if there is any topic you would like me to cover in the future, just email me at ask@thediaryofacfo.com. Again, the email is ask@thediaryofacfo.com. See you soon.